Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. We want to stress the economy again today. It's always the major issue because there is a very dire economic situation going on a global scale, and it relates to what is going on today in London, as a matter of fact. I had a before I introduce my guest, who's Jack Rasmus, and regular listeners know Jack. Jack is a professor of political economy at St. Mary's College in Santa Clara University in California, and he is a superb economist. His latest book is called Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression. He's got a new one coming out hopefully before too very long this year. He calls it Obama's Economy, Stagnation and Collapse, 2008-2010. Sure doesn't sound like much of a recovery to me. Ongoing in London today is a massive, massive protest against government-proposed austerity measures. Possibly as many as 500,000 people might amass in the streets. And I had a very busy morning. I'm doing two articles for tomorrow. I just want to mention them briefly and touch on one other thing briefly, then turn it over to Jack, and we'll talk about several articles that he has written that will be coming out. At least one will be coming out, and several different issues he'll bring in. I had two extended interviews myself this morning on what's going on in London and the reasons why, and because of the bad policies, the dire situation, the bad policies, taking care of the bankers and the hell with the people, and what the good policies are, the ones that aren't being adopted, and so on and so forth. And on the same television network, and we did it for me by telephone, thankfully, so they popped my picture on the screen. And we spent about 45 minutes in two separate segments. And besides that, I have an article updating the Japan situation for tomorrow. It is extremely dire. It is being covered up. I certainly am not in there seeing firsthand what's going on. But from everything I've seen, everything I've read, every expert I've quoted, there is something that may already be, but certainly has the potential to be the most unprecedented disaster ever. Well, that's something that I get everybody's attention. Anyway, that's topic one. I began a second article on what looks to be, and it doesn't surprise me in the slightest, that the effort in Libya, what is going on in Libya, there is an effort there to get rid of Gaddafi. I don't want to go into too much detail because we want to get on the economy. But the experts say it is almost impossible to do by airstrikes. And the insurgents on the ground, well, it's a motley crew, and they don't seem to be making much headway either. So the plan is, and I'm quoting experts who know about this stuff, including intelligence people that have inside information, I certainly do not, that there is a U.S.-led NATO invasion planned. Well, you can bet you it's planned. Whether it's coming, we'll have to wait and see. But it absolutely is planned, coming either for late April or early May, if the air assaults don't kill Gaddafi or get him to say uncle or whatever. And I don't know about killing him, but I don't think he's going to say uncle. Obama has said categorically that this will be limited. There'll be a handover to NATO. There's no NATO handover. NATO is code language for America. So the handover is entirely bogus. And now a ground assault in violation of the UN resolution 1973. One more quick thing, then we want to get on to the economy. I hope listeners know, but if they don't, A week ago yesterday, Jean-Bertrand Aristide returned to Haiti. He's there. He has no political ambitions. He wants to do other things. He's a very distinguished man aside from politics. There was a runoff election a week ago. The first round last November was absolutely fraudulent. The second round, well, it had two candidates the Haitians don't want. It probably was the lowest turnout. It hasn't been confirmed yet, but it probably was the lowest turnout, at least in decades, of a presidential election. Under 20%, it may have been well under 20%, and there is a certain more elite segment of Haiti. They, for certain, would vote for one of the candidates, but the ordinary Haitian people want nothing to do with them, so they simply sat on their hands and they never came out. Well, I just wanted to get that in, and I did not mention it on a previous program. I felt remiss by not doing it, so there you have it. Anyway, Jack is on, and we want to talk about the economy, and to me, that always gets top attention. Jack, I welcome you.
My pleasure.
Forgive me for the indulgence of going into all that, but, you know, there's always so much going on, and I only get so much airtime, so I wanted to cram as much in as possible. But let's talk about your recent writing. You have a Z Magazine article coming out, The Fiscal Crisis of State and Local Governments, and you're writing more about the public pension situation and behind the February job numbers. Let me let you talk about all that.
Well, what we see going on economically in the country today is three crises within the crisis in the U.S. The picture is a little bit different in different parts of the world. The global crisis still continues. But in the U.S., there are three areas that are preventing any kind of recovery. You know, there's a lot of hype that we got a recovery. Well, yeah, stock market's up 100% in the last 2 years. Bond markets are up even more. If you had invested in junk bonds last year, you would have made approximately 30% gain. And the year before that, 2009, you would have made a 57% gain. So the bondholders are doing probably the best they've ever done in the last 50 years. And the stock market has doubled, so stock investors are doing great. Corporate profits for the, you know, S&P 500 and large multinationals are way back, up real quick, bigger than ever before. Of course, if you read the public press yesterday, General Electric, one of the biggest multinationals, not only didn't pay any taxes, but is going to get a handsome multi-million-dollar check from the U.S. government. And that's pretty much common. You know, the particularly the tech companies and other multinationals, they're holding reportedly at least $1 trillion offshore, not bringing it back to pay taxes. And what they're doing is trying to blackmail the government and say, well, if you allow us to bring it back without paying taxes, we'll bring it back. Yeah, sure. Bring it back so they can give it to their shareholders. Corporations in general in the U.S., not small businesses, but, you know, medium, large corporations, are sitting on a cash hoard of $2 trillion, refusing to use it to invest and create jobs in the U.S. I predicted several months ago what they're going to do with this is stock buybacks and dividend payouts, which are now beginning. And the rest of it, they'll invest offshore in financial speculative instruments and maybe emerging markets, although China and Brazil and other places are purposely slowing down their economies. And, of course, Japan now is going to slow down the global economy. And what's going on in the Middle East is slowing the global economy. So they're sitting on this huge cash hoard and not using it to create jobs purposely. They got other plans for it after we bail them out. And, you know, that's a major indication of why we can't get a real recovery. The wealthiest 10% households are spending like banshees, and they account now for over half of all the consumer spending in the United States. So the top 10% is doing great, and the rest of us are barely plowing along or reducing our spending. And you just can't get a recovery with 90% of consumer households not really spending. That's one of the big problems. We don't have enough income being generated for most of the households in the economy to really get the economy out of first gear. You know, you got the top 10% spending, and you got a little bit of business spending, and a little bit of business hiring as a result, not much. It will take 8 to 9 years, it's estimated, for us to get back just to the level of jobs we had in 2007 before the recession began at the current rate of job creation that we've got going. So the first crisis within the crisis is the fact that we have somewhere around 23, 24 million people unemployed, and it's taking us 8 to 9 years. And that's reflected in the 90% households just simply not purchasing. The second crisis within the crisis is the state and local government fiscal crisis that I have an article coming out in Z Magazine next week entitled Why Public Employees Aren't the Cause of the State and Local Government Fiscal Crisis. And we could talk about the causes and why they aren't the cause. But, of course, everything you read in the press, and especially in those states where the Republicans are using the alleged fiscal crisis as a way of destroying the unions and collective bargaining and taking it out on everybody else. The third crisis within the crisis, and this is my next article coming out in Z in a couple months, is the other crisis that's not being mentioned very much. That's the housing and foreclosures crisis, which is a depression. We have in housing a bona fide depression on the scale of what went on in the 1930s. 75% collapse of that particular industry and market. And what's particularly interesting is that in housing, the government is making decisions right now to pull out of supporting a residential housing market. In other words, after 2 years of being of total failure to do anything to resurrect housing, the Obama administration is just throwing up its hands and saying, okay, let's leave and not support it. And, of course, the Republicans are all for that because that means the end of the government agencies that buy up mortgages and therefore keep the market going, agencies being Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those are going to be dismantled. And that means far less support for creating mortgages. And that seems to be their solution to the 10 million foreclosures that we've had and more rising.
Jack, can I throw in one question?
Mm-hmm.
It strikes me, you correct me if I'm wrong, that it is virtually impossible to have an economic recovery if you have a housing crisis going on, and we indeed have a housing crisis going on.
Well, that's the historical record. We've never had a sustained economic recovery without a recovery of the housing market. You know, and when I say housing market, I mean not just residential housing, but commercial properties, you know, malls and hotels and, you know, office buildings, industrial buildings are in just as bad shape. Both sectors, residential and commercial, just can't get off the ground and won't get off the ground. And we have a veritable depression in housing. And yes, you're absolutely right. We have no history of any recovery after a recession. Without the recovery of the housing sector.
And this one just keeps getting worse.
This one is particularly bad. This is the worst housing situation we've had, housing market, since the 1930s. You know, if you go back to the 2001 recession and you look at what happened immediately after 2001, we couldn't get the economy going again after that recession. We almost went back into a double-dip recession in 2002, scared the hell out of the Bush administration. And as I point out in my book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression, that's out, what Bush did is get together with Greenspan, the Fed chairman at the time, and they decided they were going to give a special extra push to the housing market as a way of trying to get the economy out of heading for a double dip in 2002 in time for the 2004 elections, okay, and in time for Bush to go ahead with his war in 2003 in Iraq. So they decided that they're going to use housing, overstimulate housing, to get out of the 2001 recession. Now, the thing is, housing was at the end of its cycle. The housing boom started in 1997. And by 2002, everybody who could afford to buy a home had pretty much bought a home. So to stimulate the economy in 2002, the housing sector, was meant to artificially stimulate that particular sector, which is what they did. 1% interest rates, you know, liar loans and the whole thing we know about. Yeah, we got a stimulus for a couple years out of housing, but it led to a housing, artificial housing boom, and then, of course, the bust that came and dragged everything else down with it. So they're having real trouble not only getting housing going, but real trouble getting real investment going in this country. In other words, building factories and plants and so forth that would create jobs in this country. It's been weak for over a decade, and it's even weaker this time. So they can't and have decided not to use housing as the leading edge for the recovery. They can't get real business spending going again because they've been plowing all their capital and spending offshore. So what do we got? We got a stagnation here that's going to go on for some time at best, and it could get worse. If we have a collapse of the banking system in Europe, sovereign debt crisis driving things down. In the periphery, we know about Portugal. Now it looks like has to be bailed out. Spain will, of course, next have to be. So they're falling like 10 pins in Europe. And I predicted in a previous article a month or so ago that we're going to see something similar emerge in the periphery in Asia economies. They're going to start descending into a double-dip recession again and having problems with sovereign debt.
Now, are you talking about China and Japan?
No. I mean the periphery of Asia. Okay, yes, Japan. I'm talking about Japan. They're already there. They're already in recession. And what's going on with the nuclear thing is going to make it even worse. They already were heading into a recession in Japan.
What countries are you referring to,
Jack? The periphery countries. The Taiwan and Thailand, the Philippines, around the southern edge.
Korea? There. South Korea?
South Korea, yeah, South Korea. But South Korea is a special case. It's kind of buttressed by the growth in China. But as China slows its economy, which it's doing purposely now, to deal with global housing speculation going on, South Korea will feel that pinch of the slowdown in China. China's raising interest rates desperately and trying to slow down its overheated economy in the housing sector because of, global money flowing into that sector from abroad. Brazil's raising interest rates, trying to slow down its economy, and all the leading larger emerging market countries are trying to slow their economies down. Which is going to be bad for the U.S. trying to grow out of its recession here by expanding export sales, manufacturing export sales. Obama has thrown all his chips in that basket that he's going to try to use manufacturing exports as a way of getting the U.S. economy out of its slump here. But I predicted that's not going to work. Manufacturing is only 11% of the U.S. economy. The big sector is, of course, services, 78% of the economy. So there's no way you can have a manufacturing-led recovery here in the United States. And as I said, it looks dubious with the situation slowing emerging markets where a lot of the exports were going to. What you see among the major economies is increasing competition over decreasing global export trade pie, right? They're all trying to get a bigger chunk of that pie. Of course, it's a zero-sum game. Whoever gets a bigger chunk is getting that at the expense of somebody else. But that's what they're all doing. That's what the U.S. Federal Reserve policy was all about. Hundreds of billions, trillions more into the global economy. That was called quantitative easing 2, drive the dollar down, which has happened, and therefore stimulate U.S. exports. And the idea was to stimulate the stock market, too. And that's exactly what happened. The stock market last summer was in decline. It looked like we were going into a double dip. And then the Fed comes up with QE2, throws money into the economy, and the stock market takes off on another big leg up. Now it looks like what's happening is it's the end. The Fed after June isn't going to stimulate any more in the economy. And what's happened with the stock market? Well, now it's slowing down, isn't it? So all the Fed pumping money into the economy was really designed to help those big stock investors make even more. and help U.S. exports increase at the expense of their European and other Asian friends.
Jack, I've got to ask you another question, too. I've seen views on both sides of this issue, whether the Fed, despite the public statements, will in fact go with a QE3 or even a QE4 or a QE5 if things get bad enough.
Well, if things get bad enough, but bad enough for who is the question, you see.
Well, if
the rest of us know, you know, they won't go with QE.
Let me define what I mean. If the markets tank, especially the bond market, if the bond market goes, well, I don't know. I mean, if they keep pumping out this money, I don't know why interest rates keep staying so low. But if the bond market gets in trouble, the treasuries, that is, and if the stock market tanks, will QE ad infinitum follow?
Well, they certainly will if it gets serious enough, but it doesn't look like it's anywhere near that for the bondholders and the stockholders. They've made some nice returns here, historic returns. It's what I call the most lopsided recovery. It's the weakest recovery since the post 1945 period. Sluggish, stagnant for most, and it's the most lopsided. You know, the top 10%, big corporations, big banks, big bondholders, boy, they made a pile of money, and they're sitting on it. So, they're all recovered. They don't care. You know, I mean, everything's fine. They don't want to spend anymore to have the rest of us join the recovery. You see, that's what the debate in these budgets is all about. No more spending. Heck, we've recovered. The world's fine. So stop your spending, government. And that's exactly what's going on. It's the same thing that went on in 1936-37, by the way. You know, the New Deal starts and we get a recovery going. We had one of the biggest stock market booms in 1936 in the history of this country. The wealthy were all pretty well off, and they said, well, we don't need any more New Deal. And, led by the conservatives in the Senate, they started cutting the New Deal in 37. We went right back down into the Depression in 38, you see. So it's the same thing. Whenever they recover first because the government bails them out first. They say, hey, this is enough. We don't need any more. And the rest of us are still struggling. That's the situation we have today. And it doesn't look good. Now you got the crazies in there, Tea Party crazies. And what they're doing is, they're victims of their own ideological nonsense. And they believe that the solution is to cut government spending even more. And they're going to do that. You know, they're going to cut the $61 billion, and it's estimated we're going to lose 700,000 more jobs if they cut $61 billion. And that's not even talking about the battle over the next budget that begins next October. That's just halfway through the current budget.
Jack, it really is crazy. I don't know what these people really think about. You know, the politicians may not be economists, but they have, or they could get, the most astute experts on whatever they want, economics or anything else. And I can't believe that these people, including the ones in the administration, aren't saying, look, this is what works and this is what does not work. Now, you guys are the politicians. You'll have to decide what you want to do. But what's going on now is not working.
Well, you know, there are smart people in Congress who know what's really going on, and there are some pretty dumb people in Congress.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, there are some pretty low-level thinkers. Come on.
I don't disagree on that for a moment.
I mean, really, they don't know the difference between their own checkbook and global economics, that's for sure. And right now, you know, they believe in these emotional ideological appeals that were created to mobilize the right wing, and they actually believe these things are true. There are smarter people, who are really pulling the purse strings and really know what's going on. And, they've basically decided that they don't need to stimulate the U.S. economy because now they're making, their big profits globally. GM's producing, I believe they just passed the point where they're producing more cars in China than they are here in the United States. And in a couple of years, you're gonna be buying electric Chinese cars. Okay, really, that's true. You'll be buying Chinese cars, and the cost will be enticing. Okay, it doesn't mean that the wheels aren't going to fall off in a year or two. The quality may be like their toothpaste quality and dog food quality. You don't know yet. But that aside, I really believe that they look at big business multinationals. They look at the U.S. economy and say, well, you know, we don't have to ensure that American workers make decent pay so they can buy our products, because now the Chinese are going to buy our products. So let's let wages and income sort of lag in the United States. We don't need to stimulate that in the United States anymore. I think that's kind of the decisions that's been made. But we've got these three crises within the crises. Once again, inability to generate jobs, and they're telling us we got to get used to 8-9% unemployment for good. Obama has no jobs program. He's essentially abandoned jobs, just as they have abandoned the housing sector and about to abandon it even further. And the other crisis is state and local government crisis. The government pumped in the first year, 2009, with the stimulus bill, $787 billion stimulus bill, pumped in $240 billion just to keep the states from collapsing. Well, they spent, they only got about $20 billion left to spend, and there's no more subsidies to the states. You see, Obama's entire strategy from the very beginning was bail out the banks, right? Bail out the big corporations like GM and so forth. Put a floor temporarily under the collapse of consumption and the states, collapse of fiscal collapse of states and cities for a year. We'll subsidize unemployment in COBRA, and we will subsidize the states for a year. And the whole idea was that in that temporary subsidization was to buy time for the private sector of the economy, which was being bailed out, to kick in and do its own job of creating jobs, right? Well, that didn't happen, as I said earlier. So Obama's grand strategy is a grand failure because the private sector just did not take over. They took the money and they run. And that's the crisis that we got. And now there's no more spending for state and local government, no more spending for the unemployed, no more spending for housing. And we're stuck with these three great crises, either of which would prevent a full recovery of the economy. Now, but we got three of them, jobs, housing, and state and local government. And there's no way you're going to get a real recovery with those three sectors in the condition that they are.
Jack,
and the worst condition, of course, is housing. It's in the depression. We've got falling housing prices once again, a double dip very clearly, and the home sales are collapsing 17-28%.
Really at dismal levels. Jack, when you say take the money and run, you're talking mainly about the bankers, and indeed, I mean,
big private non-bank companies, too.
But the banks, of course, got the lion's share of the money, and apparently they got the numbers the numbers are in the trillions of dollars, but we don't really know because the Fed has been so secretive. But they got enormous amounts, and of course they stashed it, and they paid big bonuses, and they offshored it, and they did all of those things, and they certainly have not been loaning money to stimulate the economy. So
no,
the money...
business lending by banks has dropped 13% for the last year and a half. It's dropped.
It's shocking, Jack. It's shocking.
Yeah.
Let's take a brief break, and then we'll come back. I mean, this is such a major story. It should be headlined every day in the major news with information like you're discussing coming out, but of course. Instead, they say, all's well, we're back on track again, we're doing fine, don't worry about a thing.
They've been saying that for 3 years.
Oh, indeed, indeed. Quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hi, you're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
Hello, this is Eric Ochsner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz. Every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hi, I'm Allison Rose Levy. I've been a health journalist for 25 years. I'm currently blogging on the Huffington Post. After more than two decades of studying, talking about, exchanging, and reporting on integrative well-being and collective psychology, I think we're ready to step up to the next level. On Connect the Dots, we're going to reach beyond the merely individual look at health to look at the community, societal, and global level of what we need to address to better our health. Please join me Saturdays at noon Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and I look forward to dialoguing with you.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back on with Jack Rasmus. We're talking about the economy. And indeed, Jack, as you explained so well, you really explain it well, that anybody knowing absolutely nothing about economics can understand very clearly what you're explaining, what the problems are, what the threat is. And it's shocking to me that more people aren't responding. And do they really believe what they hear and watch on Fox News and CNN? I mean, it astounds me that people actually go there for information when there is none there. There is none there.
Well, it confirms their emotional feelings, you see. There's nothing in the informational, really, about a lot of this stuff coming across in Fox News. At least the cable clowns, as I call them, you know, the Becks and the Rileys and so forth, right? They're there to entertain people and to feed them emotional appeals.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of the so-called experts they bring on, the economists and the Wall Street crowd that they bring on. Now, you get it mostly on the Bloombergs and the CNBCs, but I guess they have them on the other channels as well. And, you know, you get somebody from, anybody from Wall Street should be totally discredited, but they'll bring on somebody from J.P. Morgan Chase or Goldman or one of those firms. And, obviously they're no dummies. They know what's going on, but they lie. They don't tell people the truth about what's happening. They say everything is fine and the stock market is doing great and we'll have great returns this year. And they said it in 2007 until things came apart. They said it all the way through 2008 as things were going down, 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 down. And then the stock market crashed in a little bit in September and really got hammered in October. And I think it's very possible we're going to see a repeat of that, something like that.
Well, you really expect people who are being paid nicely by the banks to come on TV and say, well, the banks are holding $1 trillion in excess reserves and not loaning it to small business, and that's why small business can't get going. You expect them to say that? No, that'd be the end of the job. they say the message, the line that their employers want them to say, and that's why they're brought on. And I mean, people like me never get on any of these shows because then we'd be talking about the real facts.
God forbid, after hearing all those other guys and then hearing you, it would literally sound like news and information from a different planet, Jack. So different from the stuff they get. But, all the media hosts, whether on the business channels, whether on the other ones, the media hosts also have to play this game or they'll be canned. And even ones on MSNBC, supposedly a little bit more on the progressive side, the little monitoring I do, because I do media critiques, and I see where these people are coming from, and, occasionally they'll take a good stand on an important issue, but most of the time they don't, and they absolutely, a little bit I'm monitored on the Libya situation. It is shocking that they're literally backing an illegal act of aggression against another country that would, it'll be disastrous before this thing ends, and they're praising Obama for being different from George Bush. I don't know how they can say things like that. It simply is not so.
Yeah, well, that's not my area of expertise, but I understand what you're saying, sure. Let's get back to the housing crisis.
Oh,
the crisis,
so big.
If we can. People probably aren't aware at the scope and magnitude of the foreclosures that have occurred. You may have heard, people may have heard something about, last summer, the banks got caught with robo-closures, a robo-seizure scandal. Last summer, they had decided, we have enough excess reserves on hand. Now we can start forcing these people who are in foreclosure, evicting them from their houses. So in the middle of last summer, we had a huge increase in bank seizures of homes. You see, a foreclosure simply means you're not making your payments, and therefore you are, quote, foreclosed after 60, 90 days. the first step is delinquency, 30, 60, 90 days. Then you get official statement you are in foreclosure, meaning they've taken the full legal ownership of your home away from you, and they can dispose of that property. Now, until last summer, they weren't disposing of the properties as they came on the market, because they didn't. To foreclose and to take it over, you got to take a loss. The banks have to take a loss, so they didn't want to take losses on their books. So they were issuing foreclosure notices, but not seizing the homes. Well, last summer they started seizing the homes at $100,000 per month rate, and it brought attention, and people looked into it, and they found out that these foreclosures and seizures, a lot of them were being done illegally, and it created a bit of a scandal, and it slowed down the rate of foreclosures and seizures temporarily while this fight is going on, which has simply meant that the inventory of unsold homes has bottled up and grown even further. If you look at official foreclosures, in 2007, when the crisis began, we had 1.3 million. In 2008, 2.3 million more. In 2009, the first year of Obama, 3.2 million. We were on track last year until the scandal slowed things down to also have an excessive 3 million. Now, you go back to Obama's original program, in 2009, billions, trillions of dollars to bail out the banks, only $75 billion to bail out the homeowners. Most of that $75 billion, of course, went to the mortgage servicers as a kind of a bribe to get them to lower interest rates for new buyers. They lowered interest rates. We paid $75 billion, lowered interest rates maybe 0.75%. It didn't have much effect. This was called the HAMP program, Housing Modification Program. Total failure, just a handout to the mortgage banks. They pocketed most of the money and nothing happened. That was the totality of Obama's program when he first came into office for housing. And it's why, we had 3 million more foreclosures in 2009. Then we had the first-time home buyers. You know, the whole idea was, let's not bother doing anything about the folks losing their homes. Let's just make arrangements so the new buyers can buy them up, you see. Don't bail out anybody, in foreclosure. Just get them out of there and sell the houses to new folks, see. Well, that had a little bit of a blip in recovery. But that ran out as soon, and it stopped dead in its tracks as soon as they pulled that program. And then the housing market just kept going right back down on its trajectory that had begun in 2007. We've had about 10 million foreclosures, and we have at least 5 million unsold homes out there, meaning that the housing crisis and the collapse of home prices are going to continue for some time. Property values have collapsed $6 trillion since 2006. $6 trillion in value has disappeared, homeowners' value, right? The housing wealth is one half of what it was in 2005. So half of the value of residential homes has disappeared, in just 3 or 4 years, and nothing's been done about it. Okay. The Fed, of course, has bought about $1 trillion in mortgages, so it would have been even worse if the Fed hasn't. But it's not buying anymore. It's pulling out, and they're going to get rid of Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. So what we had is the lowest since 1947. People can't afford to get married. People can't afford to buy a home. we know the phenomena of young workers in their 20s going living with their parents because they have no jobs or the jobs pay part-time, very little pay, no benefits. This is a very serious situation going on in the housing sector, and no policies whatsoever forthcoming in the Obama administration to do anything about it, just as there's no policies about to do anything about the jobs, except, let's hope and pray that the businesses start hiring somebody. They've turned their backs on state and local government as well, which means now with all the radical Republican governors, it's slash and burn, make public employees pay for it. And that's why we have the fiscal crisis of state, which we could talk about as well as another crisis within the crisis here. State and local government, the number one cause of the budget crisis is not spending in general on discretionary programs. The number one cause of state budget crises is the collapse of tax revenue. All kind of studies point to this. And, of course, we've had a massive collapse of because of the recession. The recession has been not only deeper than any before, but the recovery, as we've been saying, is very sluggish. It's not occurring. That means tax revenues aren't coming back. We have a cyclical impact on tax revenues bigger than ever before, state and local government. On top of this, we've had a longer run structural decline in tax revenues as states have competed with each other to cut their corporate income taxes in a race to the bottom over the last two decades. In other words, I'll give you a tax cut business if you relocate from New York to New Jersey. Come on over here. You don't have to pay as many taxes. Or Ohio says, come on over here, and we have even lower taxes. We're robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Jack, in Chicago, they gave away the store to get Boeing to move from Seattle to Chicago. It was really shocking and shameful. They've been here for a number of years now.
But it's going on everywhere across the country, and corporate taxes at the state level have collapsed to virtually nothing. So the revenue problem is the big problem. Now, there are cost problems on the state budget side, but it's mostly health care cost, which is being driven, of course, by the gouging going on by insurance and health care industry of everybody. Of course, it's happening. I mean, you've got a lot of employees at the state and local government level, and so those costs are rising. And in particular, Medicaid costs. States pay for most of Medicaid. Medicaid is 20% of all state spending, and those costs are going through the roof. It's not that the benefits are rising. In fact, the benefits in many cases are also being cut, but the costs are rising nonetheless. The other major cost factor for states is borrowing. in the municipal bond market. The cost of borrowing have risen dramatically in municipal bond market, which means the states have to pay even more. And we're probably facing a possible municipal bond market crisis that is about the same dimension of the subprime mortgage crisis if it blows. We're getting closer to that point. And then finally, the states in their pension funds, and this is where the pension funding problem integrates into the state budget crisis problem, why do we have a big pension gap? You know, a lot of these Republican governors are saying that, oh, look, you know, where the state is underwater and huge amounts that, you know, we owe. And the main reason, of course, they point to is the funding gap. These state pensions aren't adequately funded. Well, why aren't they funded is the next question. Like Illinois, right? Illinois is not one of the worst conditions. It's barely 50% funded. Why? Well, what I'm telling people is that you need to get into and look into your particular state and our city government pension fund and find out what they've been doing with that fund over the last 10, 15 years. What I suspect you'll find is that these pension funds are short for a couple reasons. One is they've probably engaged in what's called contribution holidays. Pension funds have simply refused to put money into the fund over a long period here. It went on in the private sector, too, pension funds. We're talking about defined benefit pension funds. Why can they get away with contribution holidays, not putting money into the pension funds? Well, they manipulate actuarial assumptions and interest rate assumptions. They assume, for example, if you negotiate a pension plan, which I have, it's very easy to play around with the numbers in two ways. One, I assume that the pension fund's investments rate of return is going to be much higher than actual historic average. You know, I assume 10% rate of return. Oh, gee, the pension fund's going to do really great. Maybe the true rate's 2%. But by assuming 10%, the fund looks like it's above water, and I don't have to put money into it, you see. Or I can say, oh, over the next 5 years, we're going to hire so many new young workers, right? Now, young workers will put money into the fund, but they won't be taking it out because they're not retiring, you see. So making that actuarial assumption, I can make the pension fund again look better than it is. Well, this is what's been going on with pension funds for some time. In the private sector, too, what you can do at a pension fund is you can take the money out of the pension fund to pay for the rising health care costs in the company. You can bleed the pension fund. That's been going on as well. So this contribution holidays, how much is that really responsible for your pension fund being underwater is the question you have to ask and look into. The other question you have to ask is what have been the losses in the investment on that pension fund? After 2006, we had a pension act in the summer of 2006, which for the first time allowed pension funds, including public employee pension funds, to loan money to hedge funds, to get into the speculative markets, to get into interest rate swaps, derivatives, in other words, to invest in subprime mortgages. This is late 2006. This is the peak of the subprime mortgage crisis. You know, then it blows right after that. So this act passed by Congress in August 2006 allowed pension funds, public funds, to get in and play in these very speculative, high-risk investments, and they lost their shirt.
You know, Jack.
So you got to ask yourself, get down into the investments in the Illinois Fund and say, well, what investments did they make? And what are their losses, you see? What contributions did they not make, and why is it underwater? It's the devil's in the details, you see. And usually you'll find that it's not because of exorbitant increases in pension benefits for public employees. You know, the governor of New Jersey, Christie, came out and a couple months ago and said, oh, look at the pension funds. We've got $1 trillion shortfall in 2007, and now we got a $2 trillion shortfall. And he tried to blame the public employees for that. Well, I don't know of any public employees that doubled their pension benefits in 1 year. So it's not the increase in the pension benefit payouts. The problem is, of course, big losses that they experienced with the collapse of the financial markets. Pension funds are financial institutions. You know, they're in the same ballpark as private equity firms, hedge firms, funds, and so forth, right? They invest big time, and they invested risky, and they lost a lot of money. Now, what do we do about it? Do we cut pensions? Well, that's what the Republican governors want to do. They want to convert real pensions, defined benefit pensions for public workers, to these phony 401k plans. You know, the same thing that went on for 20 years in the private pension sector of the economy. We had over 100,000 defined benefit plans in the private sector. Today we got 28,000. They've converted them all to 401ks.
And you,
the average amount that people have in a 401k account today is $18,000.
Jack,
how are you going to retire on $18,000?
You know that 401ks, since they came out, do not perform as well as the old system that gave way to this privatized system and everybody on their own. And you know what you're talking about, the pension fund managers engaging in reckless speculation, and then you get into market turbulence, and you can spend years building up equity and see a huge amount of it just wiped away fast in a matter of months. If this isn't an argument against privatizing Social Security, I don't know what is.
Oh, of course it is. They tried to do the same thing, and they're going to try again with Social Security. But here's a number for you. The shortfall in the pension funds, according to the Pew, it's a very respectable research, private research organization.
Oh, they have a couple of them. I've quoted them in my articles. Yeah.
Okay. Right. It's about $1 trillion shortfall. All the state and city pension funds, about $1 trillion shortfall. Okay. Not the amount that Christie is exaggerating. All your normal accounts, you know, it ranges. The state pension fund administrators say the shortfall is only $650 billion. Christie says it's $2 trillion. Most states, you know, most middle-of-the-road estimates are about $1 trillion. Now, hold that number. If these pension funds, in the last 5 years, had invested in risk-free 30-year Treasury bonds with a return of 4.5%, not going after the big bucks that they didn't get, right? The estimates are, this is from the Center of Economic Policy Analysis, if they had invested in Treasury bonds, the pension funds, would have $857 billion more of assets than they have. In other words, there wouldn't have been a shortfall in state pension funds. It wouldn't exist. They'd have $857 billion more than they have today, which is about what the shortfall is, if they had invested in risk-free 4.5% returns on Treasury bonds. Now, that's a figure that people ought to really put in their hat. You know, when all this discussion goes on about, pension funds are unfunded and let's take it out of the hide of the public workers, who didn't cause this crisis, you know? They're not the ones that said to the pension fund managers, go play with the hedge funds and speculate and lose your shirt, right? If they had only done normal investing, risk-free investing. You see, I have a series of proposals on what to do about the state budget crises and the pension funding gap. The first one is, why can't... I see no reason why these are pension funds or financial institutions. Why shouldn't the Fed loan them a bridge loan of $1 trillion or even $500 billion to get over the short-term crisis and loan them at the same rate that the Fed loaned all the other banks, which is 0.25%. Okay, the Fed came out with a report last summer of its lending to banks. It lent $9 trillion to the banks, $1 trillion of which the Fed loaned to foreign banks. Well, if we can loan foreign banks $1 trillion at 0.25%, why can't we loan our own pension funds, you know, the same amount or half of that amount to bail them out temporarily? They'll pay it back at the same rate. What's going on here? You know, why only bail out foreign banks at $1 trillion when we won't bail out our own hedge fund, our own pension funds? I mean, it boggles the mind. And it's not that the Fed needs a special, legal permission to do this. It's a financial institution. The Fed bailed out mutual funds. The Fed bailed out money market funds, insurance companies. finance companies during the crisis, investment banks.
And the Fed could bail out the economy if the Fed really wanted to do it. I mean, just pump money for productive growth. Get it to the states. And, of course, the Obama administration, Jack, if the administration had a policy of getting money in the pockets of people who spend it, that could make all the difference. And a real job creation program, that could make all the difference in the world.
Yeah, well, you know, this is just a short-run solution to the crisis, to the extent of a crisis created by bad investments, negligent fund managers, you know, fraudulent activity, contribution holidays, and so forth, right? And nothing to do with public employee pensions. This has to do with mismanagement, fraudulent, negligent mismanagement, speculation, opening up these funds, encouraging them to play fast and loose with, you know, the big boys and speculation. We can stop this problem overnight with these loans. And then, you know, what's the long-term solution? Well, first of all, you got to amend the Pension Act 2006, prohibit public worker pension funds from investing with hedge funds and other speculative financial institutions. That's the first thing you got to stop, right? Second thing, you know, it is true that some of these public pension funds pay out huge benefits to the very highest paid public employees, you know, the managers, you know, the coaches of the public, you know, football teams of the public and universities, and, you know, public university directors and so forth, you know, just put a cap on how much. You know, you can't get more of a pension. You can't get a pension payout based on a base of more than $160,000 a year. You know, some of these folks get millions of dollars a year. You know, we pay football coaches millions of dollars a year. I mean, that's crazy. You know, when the college system is you know, under so much stress. Don't get me wrong, I love football. I used to play football in college, but, you know, enough is enough.
Enough is enough.
So there are abuses at the high end, but you can put a cap on that stuff, right? And we should make the banks and all those speculators pay back the states and cities for their, you know, misleading people. Most of the cities are in trouble because they got sucked into interest rate swaps. And let's make those banks pay back those cities.
Oh, absolutely, Jack. Jack, we got about a minute left. Wrap up with any key things that you want to get in before the hour is over.
Well, the key thing is we're in a crisis within a crisis, these three areas, either one of which would prevent a full recovery, all three of which are continuing, and they're what's amazing, there's no program or solution to either creating jobs by the Obama administration, bailing out the housing sector, or doing anything to stop the crisis in state and local governments. And without either of those, and all three, certainly, you're not going to get any sustained recovery, and all you're getting is once again, you know, typical spring, it's over. Well, it's not. And the longer it goes on, the more likely, if you have another financial crisis somewhere in the world, we're going to be... It will precipitate and on the road to a true bona fide depression. That's my argument in my book, Epic Recession, Prelude to Global Depression.
Jack, it's really...
If they don't do something about a real recovery, that's where we're going.
It's really depressing. I lived through one depression, but I was a little boy and I had no idea what was going on. And little did I know that I'd be living through another one, as it looks like.